The House Committee hearing on Public Employees Retirement System Committee. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2008 and public hearing on House Bill 2020, which are successor plan bills. Jim Green and Brian DeLashman, I think, had some words for us on their talks on a successor plan. And we have a letter from the Oregon University System that needs to be entered into the record on House Bill 2008, so we'll do that as well. And the committee, you should have that in front of you.
Mr. Chair, for the members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLashman representing the First Coalition. Obviously with me is my good friend Jim Green, and he can introduce himself and pipe in at any point. But we're here today to kind of fill you in on the status of the discussions between the employer group and the employees group on a successor plan. With that, I'd like to actually start with a little disclosure. Because the negotiations are still underway and we plan on meeting a third time on Thursday, we will not be specifically talking about design of the proposal or what issues we've resolved versus what issues we haven't resolved, because then that in fact makes it negotiation outside of the constraints of that room. And it's our hope, and I'm optimistic, that we will either reach an agreement or get very close to reaching an agreement, and we will be able to report back to you at that point. After the Thursday meeting, if we don't reach agreement, we'll be able to report to you on things we did agree on and what's outstanding. If we do reach agreement by Thursday, it's our hope that we would be able to come to you and unveil the agreement and all the components of that agreement. So with that kind of disclosure, let me kind of just briefly start, and then Jim can pipe in at any point. The two sides met initially last week, and then met again yesterday morning. We've spent approximately 7 hours or so in actual face-to-face, besides the discussions, obviously, with our own two separate groups. The first, obviously, task that we had was to identify, when you design a whole new plan, what are the issues? What's everything you need to think about, including, you know, survivor options, death benefits, besides the very basic things of what are the rates, what's the payment, what kind of a plan it is. We've identified roughly 20-some issues that we listed, actually got the board out. I'm a very visual person, and said, okay, issue. And we went right through them and said, okay, is there agreement on this? And if not, we set it aside as an issue yet to be discussed, and then we'd come back to it. Of the 20-some issues, we're down after two rounds to about 3 or 4 issues. So we have either made an agreement or a conceptual agreement on approximately 16, 17 of those 20-some issues. We have a couple in which we would like some assistance on, either from per staff or direction from the committee and committee staff, to get some assistance on doing some costing out of a couple of things, see whether or not we're both still where we were wishing to go. But we either got agreement or conceptual agreement on all but about 3 issues. Those 3 issues, we'll meet again on Thursday, as I indicated, and with that, I'll let Jim give you his side of the equation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the School Boards Association representing the PERS covered employers. I think Brian's encapsulated pretty well. And even if we don't come to an agreement, at least we've sat down across the table and we'll have had 10 or 12 hours across the table from each other discussing the issues. And I think that's at least been helpful to understand on the 3 or 4 things that we haven't got agreement on, why we currently have the different and opposing views. And on some of the issues, actually, I would say the employees have come to see our side, and we've got an agreement, and we've come to see their side on a couple of things, and we've got an agreement. So I think it's been very useful in that way. But Brian's right, we would need some help, or at least some assistance from either PERS staff or their actuary running some numbers to show the cost of the system, if that's available to us.
Well, I'm confident that PERS agency would make that available to you, knowing that they're looking for to be as helpful as they can in this process, and Jim was nodding back there, so I think that's a good sign that they would make that available to you, and we'd certainly try to help in any way we can.
The one additional thing that I would ask of you, Mr. Chair, is I know that we had told you we would report today. I know there was an expectation that we're moving forward. I think we are accomplishing that. I guess the question that we have to you is Thursday, will you be rolling something out or giving you a full update at that point? And does that meet your needs as far as timing? And do you want us to continue the discussion to Thursday?
Yeah, I think it would be productive as long as you're making progress to continue to meet until Thursday. I would say after Thursday, though, I think you need to hand us what you have because we do need to move forward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have a general agreement on a lot of issues, that might be helpful for us, depending on what the issues are that are remain outstanding. But, you know, I'm thankful that you were at least talking and making some progress, and I appreciate your effort.
Be happy to answer any generic types of questions without actually what are the three that are out there.
I have one question, Mr. DeLashman, and that's whether the are discussions limited solely at this point in this period you've been working in to the form of the plan for new hires, a successor system, or have you been engaging issues that affect the existing members of PERS?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good question, and I'm glad you ask it. Yes, it's actually a little both, and let me explain myself. First, obviously, it is for the new employees, but we have engaged in pretty substantial dialogue about incentives that would potentially move people over from Tier 1 or Tier 2 into a new plan that both benefit the employee and the employer. So as we discussed in front of this panel, and I think you've probably heard it a number of times, one of the things that is very important to on the employee side, particularly public safety officers, because of the age in which they retire, is health, or the gap in health insurance between the time that they potentially retire and they're eligible for Medicare. So we're looking at some way in which you can incentivize people to move over, but it's voluntarily, but it actually benefits the employer too. And we have a couple of those that we're discussing as options. So it's a little both. It's really a successor plan, but can we get people to move over so that their unfunded liability for those folks doesn't continue to grow? And they know that for anybody that moves over, they've saved some cost, but yet the employee side, there's some benefit to them because they have something that's more important to them than the potential of the upside of Tier 1 or Tier 2. They have a specific benefit, and they have the ability to buy some health care with some additional dollars.
And again, the key there is that it's the employee's option. The way we've talked about it thus far, you incentivize either Tier 1 or Tier 2 folks to make the choice. You don't force anybody that's in the current system into what we've defined as the successor system.
Mm-hmm. We think there's an opportunity to do this. Obviously, if you structure it correctly, and this is where one of the places we're going to need some assistance, but if you have the opportunity for somebody who has an existing Tier 1 or Tier 2 account, and they can buy out of that money some health care, and you can do it in a pre-taxed fashion, so it saves them money rather than them staying in the system, cashing that money out, and then buying some health care in that gap period of time. There's an advantage to them. And again, like I've said, it lowers the upward liability extremes that the employers have.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Thank you for your report.
Thank you.
Quest to get as much information about PERS as possible, I thought it would be appropriate to try to have as much information about local entities that aren't in PERS as well. And so we found at least one way to do that was to, through the PERS agency, they have a non-PERS employers with Social Security, Section 218, and there are many employers, most of them special districts, and so I'll make that available to the committee just so you can get a sense of how many public employers aren't on PERS but have Social Security issues that PERS tracks. And there is a group that of employers that likely public employers that we can't really track because they don't have a Social Security element to their plan, and they're not in PERS, and so PERS would have no reason to be tracking those. And so all counties are accounted for, so it wouldn't be any counties. There might be some cities or towns, some public entities that are of that nature, but likely most of them are going to be small cemetery districts, water districts, and those types of things that fall out of those other categories. So I just thought that may be helpful for the committee to have that information as we're looking at a new plan and who might be included in the new plan, and you know, would it be mandatory for all public employers? So just so you get a sense of how many their employers currently are not in the PERS system, and they may have reasons why they're not. So I wanted to make that note and make that available to you, so we'll get that passed out whenever that becomes available. Anyone else wishing to testify on the two successor plans today? If not, we'll close a public hearing on House Bill 2008 and House Bill 2020. Representative Butler, did you want to talk about House Bill 2330?
Certainly could.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2330, and Representative Butler, you are the only one signed up currently, so I figured we'd let you talk about it first, and then we'll go to the other bill.
Good. Thank you very much. House Bill 2330, would you like me to stay up here?
You can do anything you choose to do.
I'll just stay here if that's fine. Colleagues, House Bill 2330 is brought forward at the request of some folks that have a rural road district, and specifically in Malheur County, rural road district number 4. If you look under the background in the staff summary measure that you have, you'll find that rural road districts are a strange little anomaly. They are only formed in counties of between 19 and 25,000 population, must service at least 20,000 acres, and have assessed valuation of not less than $1 million. I have 4 rural road districts in Malheur County that were formed between the time that Malheur County was 19,000 people and when it hit 25. I think that went over a period of about 200 years that it was right in there. It finally got over 25,000 people, however. Many of these rural road districts are remote, and in Malheur County I have one in Ironside and I have one in Gentura. These are the closest organized town in Gentura would be 53 miles away from the closest organized town, and Ironside, I'm not sure how close it is to Unity now. It's not getting any closer, but it's a long ways up in the mountains. At any rate, it's difficult to find folks that will come in and work in the rural road districts from 50-plus miles away from town. And their request was that they be able to continue to hire folks that had retired and that those folks be allowed to work in excess of 1,040 hours to maintain the roads in the winters and in the spring and the summer and the fall with all of the kinds of healthy road district problems that they have, taking off the snow in the wintertime and then making the necessary repairs in the spring and then taking care of their bridges in the summer and then the fall. So with that, it's a fairly simple bill relative to what it does. It just allows a very specific issue. I don't know how many counties there are in the state right now which would even meet the criteria of having a rural road district, but they are in fact very rural and have some very specific needs. And in the particular instant case, they've had one employee for many, 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 many years, and he retired, still lives there. The road grader still parked in his yard, and he still wants to get out and run it next spring when he's retired. So with that, I bring you House Bill 2330 to address a very narrow and a very specific situation, and would appreciate your support on it.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
I have a question.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I can't resist but to ask for the justification of an individual retiring on Friday and yet continuing to work the following Monday, but making full retirement benefits and full income benefits doing the same job that he was doing before he retired, even though it may be rural. Retirement means retirement, not merely doubling one's income or substantially increasing one's income. What is your feeling on that?
I don't have a problem with folks. Many people would call that double dipping. Person is double dipping in that they are working and still receiving the benefits of their retirement. And I certainly do not have a difficulty with that, particularly when it comes to the fact that nobody else is rushing to the opportunity to move to these particular communities to do that. But in the instant cases when we have folks, and I have a similar situation, and you'll see that in the next bill that comes up, where rural schools are addressed in some of these cases, I just have very few people that want to make the effort to come to a really remote and distant community to go ahead and dedicate the time to address issues of being an administrator in a school and still being able to teach math, science, and some other type of class that would be necessary. So in this, and running a road grader isn't quite as easy as you'd make it out to be either. So temperamental equipment, sometimes in some instances the equipment is older, and you're not going to be able to find anybody that's going to, you know, rush to come. Now, the anticipation is that probably in the next 15 years somebody will want to retire and come back to Gentura, and when they do, they will probably came in off the ranch 40 years ago, and they'll probably be retired from some other job somewhere else, and they'll probably come down and run the road grader. Now, it may not be from a public job, but it'll be somewhere else that they've come back home to retire. Got some great stories about Gentura if you'd like to stop and talk about it sometime.
Representative Butler, I lived in Gentura for 2 years, and I'm not going back to run the road grader otherwise.
He's one of the great stories.
Both of them.
Thank you. Anyone else? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2330. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2421 and Dave Guile and Representative Backlund. I didn't see you back there, Representative. You're hiding back there. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Vic Backlund from House District 25. To my left is the originator of this bill, and Dave Guile is a principal at a new elementary school in Kaiser. I've known Dave for a long time, and he has come up with this bill, and I've been very pleased to bring it forward. So Dave is here to testify, and afterwards I would like to throw in a few remarks of my own, if I may. So, Dave?
Thank you, Representative Backlund. Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today on House Bill 2421. I appreciate the consideration that this committee and hopefully at some point the full legislature will be able to give this bill. Government, like all businesses, must continue to look for ways to continue to offer a high-quality product for the best possible price. While I believe that education continues to be woefully underfunded, I do believe that House Bill 2421 offers a method to keep some of the quality while reducing some of the price. This bill offers the hope of retaining the most experienced public employees at a much lower cost. Under this bill, a retired public employee may be rehired on a one-year contract for up to 5 years. However, the retiree must agree to work for the lowest pay in that particular job classification. And the employer, since the employee is drawing PERS, would not be required to pay into PERS. The savings to public employers can be substantial once this bill is fully implemented, which would probably take 2 to 3 years. To support this, I offer some examples from Salem-Kaiser School District. A current Salem-Kaiser teacher who retires at the top of the salary schedule has an annual salary of $57,348. The PERS payment for that same employee is an additional 18.58% plus a 6% employer pickup. The total PERS expense is $14,096. If the district could hire a retired teacher at the lowest pay, it would cost the district $28,558 with no PERS expense. The savings to the district would be $42,886. That savings is enough to hire an additional first-year teacher, so essentially the district would get two teachers for the price they are currently paying for one. Using the same approach for an elementary principal who is retiring would generate a savings of $34,365, and the savings for a classified employee, though less, would still be significant during these tight budget times. A rough calculation shows that once this was fully implemented, the savings to Salem-Keizer School District could be as high as $2 million per year. Additionally, there's a limitation in the bill which restricts this to 10% of the employer's workforce, so there will still be new blood getting into public service. It's also important to note that the majority of these savings would not occur in the first year. For example, Salem-Keizer School District has a memorandum of understanding with its teachers association that blocks hiring teacher retirees except in certain circumstances. This would need to be renegotiated to fully implement House Bill 2421. Also, House Bill 2421 provides a clause that restricts hiring a retired teacher who retires under an existing contract, so the implementation date will be further down the road than just next year for Salem-Keizer. But despite these cautions, I strongly encourage the committee to examine this bill and move it to the floor as quickly as possible. Public employers are making difficult budget decisions each day. Instead of layoffs, reassignments, and reduced school days, it would be far better to hire an experienced workforce at rock-bottom prices. Thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Dave. Questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Guile, the committee is considering a couple of bills now on the design of a new system, successor plan for new hires, and so we're trying to draw on the experience of how the existing system has shaped the workforce and the nature of the incentives that it creates. And I'd like to get your comments on the aspect of the current system that provides unreduced benefits to an employee who's still in his or her 50s and who has a natural incentive to want to retire to capture that unreduced benefit and then be able to draw a paycheck at the same time. Is that a system that you think is something we ought to replicate in the successor plan, or is that something you think ought to be adjusted for when we look down the road at where our workforce is headed?
Well, first, having not read the other House bills that you refer to and knowing what all is entailed in successor plans, it's difficult to answer that succinctly. But generally, I think the system currently rewards people who've put in a number of years in the system, 30 years plus. And I think that's a good incentive. And there are a number of employees who would not take advantage of, in a successor plan or even under this plan, of going ahead and working beyond their 30 years or a certain retirement age. But I do think it provides an opportunity for government to take a look at retaining some experience in any public service, and to do that through an incentive of saying, yes, you can go ahead and retire, and you can draw a paycheck, be it far reduced from what you were receiving. I think it's a worthwhile thing for the committee and the legislature to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I have a question that may be more appropriate for the PERS staff, but I don't know if they're coming up on this bill.
They are.
They are. Then I'll hold off.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry if I missed it. How do they determine who gets the job? I mean, not everybody that applies gets it. Is that correct?
That is correct. If in the case of Salem-Keizer School District, let's say they have an elementary principal vacancy, which I'm an elementary principal, so it's easiest to speak to that. They could advertise that position and hire, in this case, if this was in force, a retired elementary principal to fill that position, but that person would have to agree to work at the lowest pay in that position. And at no time could Salem-Keizer School District, as an employer, exceed 10% of their workforce in those positions. So there's a limitation there to how far they can go with it, but they would be able to make a choice between a brand new principal and one who has just retired or retired a couple of years ago but still is licensed.
A follow-up and a different question. As people get older, they're more susceptible to injuries, on-the-job injuries and so on, although I'm not quite sure in the schools. But what about workers' comp? Somebody's retired and they get hurt, then what happens?
Well, I assume the workers' compensation would cover them just like it would for any other employee, and so there may be certain occupations that would have a bigger impact on, but I can tell you that all my injuries occurred earlier in my career when I did crazier things than I do now.
Thank you.
The 10% prohibition, or not exceeding the 10%, that doesn't apply to classifications. It just applies to the district in general. So they could have, their 10% could all be teachers that are retired, or they could be classified. I don't know if you could get to 10% on principals in any district, but of your total workforce.
That is correct in the bill, the way it is currently.
Okay. Other questions?
I just had one question, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Could Ben Backlund go back to work under this bill?
Well, I suspect he could. But I don't know that he would. Representative Backlund, do you want to speak to that?
Chair Canope and members of the committee, this bill, if it were enacted, I believe would permit the school district to hire any retiree, including this one, because I'm sure that I would fall within that 10% number. Mr. Chair, I did have a few things to add to what Dave has testified to. I think probably all of us have had lots of emails on the issue of public employees being very concerned about the PERS situation in general and about some of the attempts that have been already ongoing and will continue to be ongoing regarding PERS reform. And so about that time, Dave called me up and asked me to come out and tour his school, and also he had a bill for me. And probably his real interest was in showing me the bill. But I did that, and I got to thinking, as this has progressed, how many people have called or how many emails on this subject of public employees would like to continue to work, but they feel the need to retire earlier than they would really like to retire. And I was thinking of all public employees, the numbers of people who are experienced, talented, capable, lots of brain power, lots of experience that will be lost if we have this rush of people to retire, as I read and as I hear that we're going to have. The state has a lot of public employees who could retire, and many, I'm sure, will choose to do just that. I approach this, not that many others may, but I approach this as a real benefit to public employers. I think this, you think of it in this way, it would be certainly an employee who wanted to continue is fine, but the public employer would really benefit. There are many, many, many issues in this bill that would demonstrate that. The lower salary, the restrictions on how many public employees could do this, no PERS on the part of the employer, the savings that Dave has outlined just in one instance, and we could be talking county government, we could be talking city government, special districts, all kinds of classifications of employees. So I think it would mitigate those people who are concerned about what Representative Butler has referred to already as double dipping. I also would add one other thought or a couple thoughts. I don't think this bill necessarily is the final process or should be. Dave and I have talked about that. There's a piece in there that would have the employee giving 6% of his salary back to the employer, or in effect back to PERS. That piece I'd be very willing, if you're interested, to have that removed, to have that amended out. In terms of some public employees, I think there is a sense of urgency. For example, in the school business, typically principals would be hired in the summertime, and so I would think if you're interested, we should put in an emergency clause. So that if we pass this bill, or we pass this bill sometime between now and July, it would take effect immediately, because a lot of people will be hired normally in the summertime. I think probably There are a number of other considerations, but we're interested in providing an opportunity for public employers to take advantage of some very talented people who are retiring earlier than they really want to retire, and yet making it a good situation for the public employer and for the PERS system. So some philosophy, some background, some thoughts. So that's my two cents worth. Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Could you tell me, some of these public employers would have labor contracts. Would this set aside the agreements under the labor contract?
Chair Canope and Representative Brown, the last section of the bill deals with negotiated contracts, and that could be problematic. Dave has referred to that earlier. But I've also talked to a couple of colleagues, and those colleagues indicated that those provisions could be dealt with, and maybe the idea is that it could be implemented right away.
So it would take, if you're going to implement it right away, to take an agreement with the unions representing those employees or that group of employees?
Chair Canope, Representative Brown, I'm not sure the particulars. I talked to a colleague who happens to be an attorney, and I showed him that section of the bill, and he seemed to think that could be dealt with in a way that would not force the potential public employee retiree to have to wait. Say it's a two-year contract, he wouldn't have to wait 2 years, in other words. Or maybe they're in the middle of a two-year contract and he wouldn't have to wait for a full year before he could be hired back in this status. But that's kind of a question that has not come from that came from a colleague who has some experience, but it's just kind of word of mouth.
Mr. Chair. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Guile, something that both of you mentioned in your testimony provokes this question, and that is you both referred to a concern about a brain drain or a rush to the door. I know you didn't participate in earlier deliberations of this committee, but part of our intention in the way we designed the transition on the life expectancy tables was to prevent that, to take away the incentive to rush to the door by providing a smoothing effect on the benefits that retirees would receive. By still referencing that in support of this bill, are you saying that you don't think that the smoothing we did will be effective in retaining talent within our workforce?
I think there will be some impact of that, but it won't be huge because I think there are too many other PERS bills in the legislature right now that have public employees nervous when they hear things about rolling back the 8% guarantee, even though the bill that currently is in process just is the cap at 8%. What it appears to many public employees is that PERS will be changed so significantly that it would take them years and years to get them back to where they are now. And because no successor plan is in place, no one can give any hard facts to a public employee that says, yes, if you continue to work, your benefit will gradually increase, or you will make it back up in 1 year or 2 years. Consequently, those people who are eligible are more likely to go ahead and jump ship now, I think.
You follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. Mr. Guile or Representative Backlund, have either of you consulted with other representatives of public employers about this bill and whether this works for them as you've drafted it, or do you have support from other public employer groups?
I have not done that. Okay. This is my first time in the legislative process.
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan. No, I did not. I consulted with, or Dave consulted with me, and we talked, and he handed me a piece of paper, and I thought about it. And I just kind of envisioned how this thing could be a benefit to the state of Oregon and to public employers as well as public employees.
And Representative Backlund, you already mentioned that you thought that this was not necessarily the final say on this proposal. I just wanted to get a sense
of
how broad the interest in it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe this hearing will pique their curiosity, and you may have a flood of people wanting to support this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's similar other proposals I've seen coming up, one called a drop plan, defer early retirement option plan. And with regard to the labor negotiations, normally the contract supersedes the law. I mean, we can write a law, but if they have a contract, that would have to be changed. And it also has been my experience in talking with people over similar things like this, is the labor organizations are very skeptical of plans that limit and allow the employer to pick and choose who gets to stay in what is considered to be a bonus plan and who doesn't. And another thing, that at a time when we need jobs in Oregon, this will not only plug up the new hires, slow down new hires, but also will discourage those who are working and are ready, they're seeing you ready to leave the door, and they're thinking, now is my opportunity for promotion, and then suddenly you're going to be there another 5 years. And in similar programs under the DROP program, what that has done, deferred option retirement plans, is literally just stop everything at a standstill for the period of time, whatever, 3 years or 5 years or whatever they do on those. But I wonder if you had thought about that at all.
Well, Representative Barker, actually, I believe this will increase employment from what it might be looking at the kind of budget cuts that public agencies are looking at. When we look at Salem-Keizer School District and we're looking at an increase in class size, that means a reduction in the number of teachers. And if you take $2 million and you can apply that to additional teaching positions, then actually I think you're able to save that kind of reduction, actually add jobs. So I think because you're getting a cheaper workforce, the potential is there to actually have a better hiring opportunity than what we will without some kinds of cost savings for public employers.
Chair can open. Representative Barker, I think you raise a good point. Again, we're interested in the big picture. For example, if you had interest in this, you could certainly impose a sunset, because say in 5 years from now there might be a lot of employees to take the positions that right now this bill would allow retirees to take. So from our perspective, there's plenty of flexibility. We're looking at the overall concept of allowing public retirees to come back and benefit themselves, but certainly public employers as well, and maybe even more so at the public employer level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate some of the questions and some of the concerns, and it almost scares me in some respects that folks would be concerned that if they saw retiring teachers and administrators coming back, that somehow they would be fearful that they wouldn't advance. I would hope that the cream would always rise to the top, and that those folks would always have their opportunities to strive to be the best person for the job. But with that, I just would refer to line 15 on page 1 of the bill. That's where this pickup, that the employer may not pick up or assume or pay the employee's contribution under the PERS obligation. And Representative Backlund, you and I have talked about this once previously, and I would like at some point for us to take a look at the a pool of, and I've done this, what I call my Harper School bill. I'd like for us at some point to go through an exercise and take a look at what happens for a group of employees who are all covered payroll versus a group of payroll employees with all covered payroll with the exception of just 10% or just a small fraction. And what you'll see is the actual overall cost to the school system isn't, there is a savings of the additional compensation, but because there is a reassessment of the covered payroll, there's actually an increase in cost. And I commended Representative Backlund earlier for having figured that out, and he said, no, that you had figured that out, Dave, that you just said that 6% would go back in in effect as the contribution on behalf of the employee, but it doesn't add to the employee's account, but in effect the employer would transmit that in for the total obligation. And it comes amazingly close to the actual overall cost of the employer in having some non-covered wages. And it's a fairly lengthy computation. I've done it with Director Voitko and Steve Delaney previously have gone through that under the Harper Schools bill. But this is of concern and some consternation to some folks who have looked at this saying, well, you're getting something for nothing. But here, this what it does is it compensates the school district for being able to do this because they do have a higher PERS rate in that process. So I would say, I don't want to see amended out. I think it just compensates the folks for their actual costs to bring that additional employee back in. It's not a true loss to the overall system.
Other questions? Thank you, Representative Backlund.
Mr. Chair, one last comment. I used to like to, in talking to students, or baseball players, you know, keep your eye on the ball. And the ball here is the big picture, is the big concept. The details we would leave up to you and to your group's expertise. If you like the concept and the general framework, we would certainly encourage you to move ahead with this.
Thank you, Representative Backlund.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think it'd be appropriate to probably have Steve Delaney come up and talk about 1040 rules. And we have a Umpqua Community College letter from their president regarding the situation that's kind of happened in Douglas County. And that letter, I think, is going to be distributed to you shortly, but we wanted to enter that into the record for House Bill 2421.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney with Oregon PERS and also PERS Director Jim Voitko. We're just here to give some brief comments on the background of how PERS treats reemployed retirees at the moment and be available to answer questions you may have with regard to the current statute and how it works. Also, we will be requesting one minor modification to House Bill 2421. With regard to our current statute, I've cited here for you the statutes that currently guide PERS with regard to reemployment of retirees. 238.078 simply tells a public employer that if a reemployed retiree wants to come back to full-time employment and become a PERS member once again by stopping their retirement benefit and just become a normal contributing member, they may do so. In 082, you have the language dealing with the limit, the 1,039-hour limit, that states that any PERS retiree can be reemployed and work a limit of up to 1,039 hours per calendar year. So it does, that 1,039 does restart with each change of the calendar year. There is an exception to that. One is that a person can also, once they reach age 62 and begin receiving Social Security benefits, they can work the greater of 1,039 hours or whatever salary they might be getting up to the Social Security limit without a reduction. And I've listed here for you what the current salary limitations are, and I should point out, I didn't put in my memo, that this is as of January 1, 2003. So these are the limits for the year 2003. One important change that has occurred, and you'll notice that for age 65 and on, there is no longer a salary limit for Social Security, so there is no longer a limit for PERS either. Therefore, a PERS retiree age 65 and over can work unlimited number of hours. There are some other minor issues with regard to special groups that are cited here in my memo. I've also attached for you, just to give you some sense of what other states are doing, the state of Idaho put together a survey of the western states and what they're doing with regard to reemployed retirees, and that's this document they have attached. I will point out that it's already out of date because what they said with regard to Oregon has changed. You notice under Oregon limit on working, they talk about age 70 and higher, but that changed with the change to the Social Security law. Now that Social Security no longer has a limit for those age 65 and over, and again, an individual who is retired in age 65 can work unlimited hours. That's the basic sense of how we have statute and what it tells us to do with regard to retirees. I do want to point out the one modification that we would ask for on House Bill 2421. On line 6 of the bill, it states that the limitations on employment of retired members imposed by ORS 238-0822 do not apply to any retired member. We would ask for the insertion that any retired member who has reached normal retirement age. That's an Internal Revenue Service issue, a criteria that we have to be sure we meet. Representative Butler's bill, House Bill 2330, does have that language within it, but 2421 would need that correction to make sure that the Internal Revenue Service is simply concerned that a person have reached the normal retirement age of a plan before being given these particular options of working with unlimited hours. I'm available to answer questions that you may have on the bill.
Questions for Steve or Jim? No.
Here.
I represent no one.
Thank you. We got some discussion on this issue, but I want to be very clear on if you have done analysis. An individual employee here or there probably doesn't affect the system overall, but if 10% statewide of all positions otherwise covered by PERS would now be covered by people whose payroll is not contributing to PERS, what would that do to our ability to retire the unfunded liability?
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, we have had extensive discussions with the systems actuary and done some analysis on this question, and we've come to the conclusion thus far that when a retiree who's a non-contributing employee fills a contributing employee slot, a member slot in our system, that the effect on our actuarial standing is modest one way or another. And the reason for that is that there's a net, the effect is net. They're not generating any new pension obligations for the system, but they're also not making any contributions. So that from a going forward point of view, it seems to be close to a wash, according to our actuary. However, remember that our current rates have a second component associated with them, and that component is the employer's fixed obligation associated with amortizing the existing UAL, which you referenced, and the obligation to pay all of the costs of retirees, the benefits and force reserve. Those are a fixed obligation that head down, that we send down the pipe to the employer. They are expressed in terms of a tithe or a rate of pay reduction on contributing employees. So to the extent that the number of contributing employees shrink, that part of the bill doesn't shrink. It just gets averaged over a smaller number of contributing employees, and so the rate per person goes up. So employers don't end up paying more, but they do pay a higher rate expressed on their remaining employees. Now, if this were to happen system-wide on an even basis, it would be just an even-steven kind of deal. However, if you're within a pool, and say there are two employers in the pool, and one of them uses completely retirees to staff their operations, and the other one has contributing employees, then within the pool, the financing for this nut, if you will, this fixed cost, shifts over to, it seeks out the contributing employees. And if they are disproportionately in employer B versus A, then there are potentially some cost shifts that can go on inside of pools. Have we done an extensive financial analysis of that? Absolutely not. We only have a sense of the direction, because the number of 1039 exception employees thus far in the system has not been that big, and we have no evidence that it is not sort of uniformly accessed. But there always is the potential for more aggressive use by some parties of these kinds of exceptions than others, and that may or may not be something that the legislature feels is important to consider.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, when we talk about being more aggressive for hiring these folks, this bill limits it to 10%. Does that modify your discussion?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, it does, in the sense that the most that two employers, employer A and employer B, could get out of whack or have a differential, if you will, is 10% of their respective workforces. And I would also say that the 6%
employee contribution happens to be very, very close to at least the current charge per capita that's associated with the amortization or the payoff of the UAL as it's analyzed today. Now, that rate will grow in the next rate setting, but it just, I think it's a happenstance perchance, but it's one of what we're discussing is one of the issues about being pooled with other employers, and presumably they behave within the pool in reasonable concert with one another.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, if I could also point out, with regard to that 10% limit, that is Section 7, but you notice too that the bill in Section 8 specifies that this section doesn't prevent an employer from hiring a reemployed retiree under the other provisions of 082. So this is one special provision, someone hiring on for a given number of years and paying out the 6%, and that's limited to 10%, but all the other provisions of 082 remain in effect, so they could do other hires under the normal 1039 rules.
Yes, that's correct.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Delaney, I believe I've seen press accounts indicating that there are at least some public employees who have retired and then come back to work within the 1,039-hour rule, but are on an understanding with their public employer, are in fact working more hours than that. Has there been any analysis by the PERS system of that phenomenon? Do you have any, and if not, do you have any feel for to what extent that is actually going on?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I have to clarify, the accounts that I'm thinking of deal with retirees that may have come back and work a certain number of hours for pay and also have offer volunteer time. Is that, are those,
yes,
issues
that you're... that's the phenomenon I think I'm referring to.
It is a difficult issue for PERS because we're not necessarily the policemen of these issues. The employer and employees have to work out their agreements. We have cautioned employers that if the agreement to volunteer a certain number of hours is a requirement, that they cannot work their 1039 and receive a certain salary unless they also work a required number of volunteer hours, that would be difficult for PERS to administer, and we would in fact find that entire period to be covered employment, and so it would exceed the 1039. Is it a major issue? Not at this point. It's just, as you've seen in the news articles, it's begun to sort of raise its head. We had one specific appeal case in the last year where this came up, and it's because it was very clear there happened to be board minutes where the individual was told by the board, we will only hire you if you work also 1,000 volunteer hours. And so there was clear documentation on the issue, and PERS could not ignore that when it was brought to our attention. I'm not sure if that's responsive to where you're going, but that's my background.
In many ways, Representative McPherson, this is less a financial analysis question as to what constitutes volunteerism under the PERS statute, and is this really volunteerism, or is it a full work year, as Mr. Delaney said, that simply has been packaged in, you know, in two parts. And it puts us in an uncomfortable position, as he said, of having to be sort of a policeman and standing against volunteerism, which who wants to do that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I just asked the attorneys at the dais, what's the enforceability of the contract that offer or the mandate you to volunteer time? I probably is not enforceable in some respect.
Nor did I intend to suggest that it wouldn't be.
Representative Nolan.
Mr. Delaney, can you tell us how many people you're aware of who are working under the IRS rules over 65 and working unlimited hours? Numbers or percentage?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, no, I can't, because, of course, in that scenario, the employer would not be reporting them to PERS. That would be an individual who, by working these hours, is exempt from PERS, and they would not show up on any reports that would come into PERS, so we'd be unaware of that individual.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Thank you. Caro, is it Dickerson or Dickens? Caro, what do you think? No Caro? No carols. Okay. Tom Heiser.
My name is Tom Heiser. I'm a substitute teacher. I live here in Salem. Do you need my address?
Nope.
Okay. I'm representing the Oregon Substitute Teachers Association, and we are opposing this bill for several reasons, which we've outlined in our letter. The biggest thing that comes to our mind is that students who want to become teachers have to go through a great process through the licensing for their credential, and then they are thrown into a market, and right now that market is very bleak indeed. Point number one, at the upcoming April Oregon Teachers Fair, right now there are 540 applications for 82 positions in kindergarten through third. There are 549 applications for 85 positions in grade 4 to 6, and 238 applications for 72 positions in middle school. We looked at this and we thought, this is really shorting those people who have dedicated their lives to becoming or trying to become teachers, and they are thrown into a position where they will not receive employment. And this will make it even more difficult for them, because there are now 10% of retirees who can return without essentially any penalties to their lifestyle. I respect Dave, and I've worked with him, and I like him a lot. And I heard his ideas, and I thought, sounds good, but the cost savings in our circumstance, I think, would not be implemented in terms of hiring new teachers. I think it would just be to save the districts their money that they need to at this, in this terrible time of a low tax structure. So we reject it for that reason. Their current statute allows 130 days for a teacher to complete a year if necessary, if they wish to retire at this point, and even to take on part of next year. So that wouldn't be a severe effect to the districts for those that need to bail out, as I've heard the term used this year. I don't think that would be an immediate effect. You have people who would be in this lowest salary position giving 6% of their lower salary with no direct benefit or any benefit at all to them. So they're paying 6% even less than their job to continue working. So I don't know how effective that would be in recruiting new teachers and benefiting PERS. One of the real problems we looked at is these teachers that are coming out that can't get hired have a 6-year limitation on attaining a continuing license if they are not hired. So they are sort of pushed out of the field if they cannot be hired, and they've spent all this time being educated. And it's a difficult set of rules that we have to deal with in getting our credentials. And so you need to consider that in your thinking. This rule may be good for our current problems, but in the long run, we feel it would be detrimental to the educational community as a whole and into our future thinking. It is going to force those people with fresh ideas out into other states or into another profession altogether. And so we consider this bill, while I heard the thinking and I thought, well thought out, but there are some things that need to be spoken to, and this is just one field that I'm dealing with, of course, is teachers. And so as the teachers, Oregon Substitute Teachers Association is recommending that you vote no on this bill and not consider it at all.
Thank you. Questions? Tomlin?
Just one question, Mr. Chair. I would indicate that you don't know how effective this would be with regard to attracting and returning teachers. If it becomes law, I guess we could see whether or not it does attract the returning teachers at the lowest compensation, where they're paying back for the fact that they're non-covered employees for PERS.
In which case, it would be a moot point. I agree.
Yeah, at that point, you've made our point in saying, well, we tried it and it didn't work, and the substitute teachers. But I do have some concern with regard to the fact that the teacher to continue to maintain a degree and to get that go from an initial teaching license to the continuing license must teach at least half time. And you feel like that these other folks that are teaching full time then would create, even though it might create new teaching positions, that this could create a problem for substitute teachers?
Well, a lot of our substitutes come from new teachers because they are unable to be employed, and yes, it would create a problem for them because we're not under the plan, the developmental plan. The substitute teachers cannot go to one school. We have no director that will implement the improvement plans that are involved with. I'm not even sure what that is. So
okay, thank you.
I think that's our biggest concern, is that the immediate response for this year, if it was employed, there would be a 10% loss of new jobs available for teachers that have just graduated. If it was fully taken advantage of.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Heiser, I look at your information that you've given relating to the number of positions and applicants versus number of positions available, and you go as high as middle school. One of the concerns, of course, is assuring that there will be enough teachers to carry the load. And can you tell us what the number of applicants were for high school versus number of...
This is just for a current job fair coming up, and apparently there were no high school people looked at it, this one. So this information was gathered by someone else. I don't have that knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Manton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Manton. I work for the City of Portland Office of Management and Finance. I'm going to be very brief because fortunately most of the committee members have asked questions to the issues that I was going to bring up. I'm taking a neutral position on this bill, but I thought that there were things that you should think about. First off, you need to remember that this is a benefit. You're adding on a new benefit to the system, and benefits always have costs. And the costs have already been delineated by Representative Butler and others in terms of the 6%. But a few of them, one of them that you haven't hit on is the fact that, of course, you're going to have an older workforce. And as you have an older workforce here, your health care costs are going to continue to rise also. And that's going to skew your pool of employees, and so your insurance rates will go up because you have an older pool because of these people. Your payroll on this bill are going to drop probably. But you have to remember that in the last session we passed a bill that had one employee or maybe two employees in a county of under 35,000. This time we're coming forward with bills, at least two bills right now, that are going to deal with retired employees, some all the way across the system. It seems to be expanding exponentially, where I can see the next time we could come up with one that takes all limits off of retirees and allows them all to work after they have completed their service. And if that's the case, your PERS costs are probably going to increase, primarily because of the things that Mr. Boyko had talked about earlier. Once again, we don't know what the answers to those PERS costs are, but as with everything PERS, it has unintended consequences for just about every bill that you put forward here. So I caution you to take a number of those things into consideration as you move forward. Finally, the final point being, we are adding on to a statute that is already totally convoluted. I'm always concerned when there are new language and new benefits conferred to current employees because of the way it deals with the whole statute. So I would caution you to take that into consideration, too, before you vote on this bill. Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you. Bob Livingston, Brian DeLashmet.
Go ahead, Bob. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters.
And I, too, would take somewhat of a neutral position on this bill. However, I would lean probably towards more of opposing the bill than supporting it in its current form. Some of the things that I think have already been mentioned, but I'd like to articulate a little bit further, is that placing something in statute for a short-term problem, I think from a policy standpoint, is problematic. And I think that Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson hit on the point, is that, as Brian and Jim Green discussed, there is the potential of a successor plan that may be coming to you or that you are going to be dealing with, and I am not sure how something like this would fit into that in the statutory schemes surrounding that. So although I can appreciate and understand, and certainly I have members that are in the same position that Mr. Guile is with all of the uncertainty surrounding PERS, from a bigger policy standpoint, I do have concerns with that. Also, some of the things that I think that you need to contemplate are some of the unintended consequences of a bill like this. For example, I think some of you have mentioned it, is that who would choose the 10% in the current form of who would be the 10% of the employees that would be eligible for that, and would that cause certain personnel issues or even labor issues that Boley or others would certainly want to look at? I don't have the answer to that. A second point under unintended consequences is, in attempting to try to find some fiscally cheaper ways of doing things, the public administration side of me and my background tells me that there are some risks and ramifications to do that from a human resource and personnel management standpoint that I can't articulate today, but that portion of my educational background tells me that that's something that needs to be further evaluated and looked at before you would go forward on a bill of this type. And then certainly the last point that I would close with, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that there are other options that are out there that are already in front of this committee, and I think that Representative Barker broached on one of those in other forms, such as a drop plan, such as the one in House Bill 2723, that certainly other states, as they've looked at pension systems, have looked to review, that certainly could potentially fit into not only a short-term fix for the current issues that we're doing in PERS, but also as we look at a successor plan, may potentially have a better fit. And before you move forward on a piece of legislation like that, I would certainly hope that you would look at House Bill 2723 to maybe see if this meets the needs in not only employers but employees before you go forward. And with that, unless you'd like Brian to make comments, so before you take questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Brian, you have any other additional comments? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I listened to Representative Backlund, and I would have been a much better hitter if he'd have been my coach look at the ball. Unfortunately, I was a very good defensive player, but I didn't hit as well as I probably could have, and my coach was not a very good hitting coach. But I think I am looking at the bigger picture. I think I'm trying to keep my eye on the ball, and my comments are not a reflection of the PERS Coalition. It's just the clients that I represent. They've all looked at the bill, the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, FOPO, and AOCE, and they see some of the same flaws in the way that this bill is written that have already been discussed. So we're interested in an ongoing discussion about how do you not have a brain drain, and in reference to Representative Nolan's question to the good principal, we were hoping that you wouldn't have a brain drain if you designed a transition to a mortality table in such a way that people were not anxious to get out. But I think you're probably also hearing from him that the other things that are going on continue to kind of swirl the controversy, and people are panicked to get out. So until we get all the way through what the big picture really is, the design of a new plan, how we deal with some of the other elements that are out there, some contained in 2003, I think there probably is at least some panic there. But the one thing that I would mention to you, and it's in relationship to what Bob had talked about, is how does this fit into the whole picture? Without giving away some elements of what we're talking about in successor plan, let me run a scenario. As you design a successor plan and you implement a date for that, and then you have people that are retiring under Tier 1 or Tier 2, is there in fact some cost savings that can be captured
by those people leaving service that are in Tier 1 and Tier 2, and, excuse me, Mr. Chair, not Tier 3, a new plan, a successor plan, that can be captured, that we can actually, it's a tangible number. You create a situation by having these kinds of bills without looking at the bigger picture in which people continue on and there isn't that capturing of those savings under a successor plan. I don't know the answer to that, but that's just one that I would throw out, is again, looking at this in isolation rather than looking at everything that's being done on PERS, you may in fact create a situation where local governments, school districts, so forth, are not capturing what they may in savings on a new successor plan. So, with that, I'll end my questions.
Thank you. Mary Botkin, is Mary still here?
There she is.
Beth Ann Darby, do you want to come up too? She has the last two on the list, and Rich. Make it a three-seat testimony here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to also be fairly brief. We represent a lot of folks in public safety. We have about 2,500 folks working in corrections. We have Port of Portland Police. We have a lot of parole and probation officers in both juvenile and the adult system. We don't think an older workforce is always the best thing, and I certainly do not want to diminish the importance that the experience of some of our older workers have to bring to the job. And because of that, we have provisions in the law now which allow somebody to work up to 6 months. And we have utilized that in some areas. Representative Butler is aware that we used it extensively in staffing up some of the facilities, especially Snake River in his district. To be quite honest with you, what we found was an overutilization of management personnel and an underutilization of frontline workers. Unfortunately, while management in some cases had worked their way up through the system, not everybody had. And so sometimes you actually need somebody who's held keys in their hand or walked in the yard to help new officers in a correctional environment. And we have, you know, we've had some struggles with getting that kind of experience in the area that it's needed. The other group that we represent are very highly paid professional employees, forensics technicians, folks who work at the state hospital, doctors and nurses over there. Again, sometimes a younger workforce brings with it some fresh ideas, some new ideas, and a new way of doing business. And, you know, with the 6 month provision that's currently in the law, it provides us the opportunity and it provides our employers the opportunity, the flexibility that they need to bring in experienced workers and experienced staff to work with new staff, kind of teach them the ropes, while at the same time we can utilize some of the new ideas that the younger workforce brings with it. And the last thing I want to say is that I think it's important that we acknowledge the fact that Oregon has the highest unemployment rate, or one of the highest unemployment rates in the country. We need to allow retirees to retire and live out their retirement in some kind of dignity and spend their money while we employ new people to spend their money. That's how the economy works. That's how the economy grows, is we get people to go to work and spend money. And I don't want to cut down on jobs. I want to expand them. And this bill cuts down on them, and I don't want to do that right now. So that's all I have to say.
Chair Canopa, members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Oregon Education Association in opposition to House Bill 2421. OEA recognizes that allowing retirees to rejoin the workforce without limitation on the number of hours that they may work solves short-term budget issues for employers, and it also provides employees with a level of certainty in these uncertain times. OEA believes, however, that the current law accomplishes the same goal without jeopardizing the public trust and ensures that new employees have an opportunity to pursue their career goals and gain additional responsibilities. So much of the current debate on PERS has put into question whether the public can trust the legislature and the PERS board to properly administer PERS. The public also questions whether public employees are taking advantage of the system. We've heard many times this session about the legislative need to weigh the public's perception with identified problems in the PERS system. We urge the committee to carefully consider that concern as you review this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Rich Peppers with SEIU Local 503, and I just wanted to come forward and get our views on this on the record as well. Generally, we think that employers do have, we appreciate and sympathize with employers who are trying to find some creative solutions to the budget problems that exist. And generally, conceptually, the notion of retirees coming back to work, we're not opposed to, conceptually. But in particular, this bill raises concerns for us around three areas. One is the collective bargaining agreements and the way those are dealt with under this bill. It essentially, one provision allows for people to, and that doesn't just allow, but requires that if they're going to come back to work, they would be working at entry-level pay in positions that normally they would be qualified for and get much higher pay. That's a collective bargaining issue for us, and that's a concern. Secondly, there's a fairness issue in this bill. It just doesn't strike us as appropriate to have people making contributions into the retirement system, but those contributions do not go into their retirement benefits in the long run. And the third issue is one that's been touched on also earlier. We think there is a need to keep an eye on new job generation and new employment generation. The next crop of more experienced people have to be brought in and trained over time, and this bill, while it only deals with the 10% number, still has a negative effect on that goal. And that would be my testimony. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. My wife would agree with you, Mary, that people who are retired should retire. But as my good colleague, Representative Richardson, pointed out, that this salary, you can't really consider this job double-dipping.
I noticed that there was whispering going on down that end of the BS.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2421? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Arnie Landsberg. I live in Corvallis, and I'm a retired federal employee. And I'd like to tell you about a very pleasant experience I had and about a concern that I have. When I retired from the federal government, I went back to work for a year and worked half-time. And I was paid half-time of half of my retirement salary or benefits and half of my regular salary, which worked out very well. My co-workers saw what was going on, and they more or less approved of it. In most instances, when a person goes back to work or works part-time, they would make more than their retirement benefits alone, so it would be worth their while. I realize that sometimes in PERS now that's not the case, but I had a half a year of very productive work. It gave me a transition from working life to retired life, and with a little bit reduction in my take-home pay, which was a good lesson. I could see this happening with PERS. I personally know a couple teachers I've helped out in the school since I've been retired who are afraid of losing their retirement, but they're also getting older and sitting or handling a classroom of eighth graders all day long is more than they'd like to put up with. But they would be very amenable to working half-time if they could receive and not be penalized with half of their PERS. While I was working my half-time retirement, there was a raise in retirement, and that I got that raise in the retirement system, and I could see that same thing could happen with a person working part-time and getting all the benefits that would accrue while they were working part-time. My concern, that worked out very well for me, those around me, and so forth. My concern is that I have neighbors who see people retiring with PERS or hear about it, and they've said out loud, by golly, if this can happen to a state or a city or a school worker, and I don't get that in my particular situation, they're not going to get any more tax money out of me. I think it's a real divisive situation. I also received some advice when I retired. A person who'd been retired for quite some time said, don't volunteer for a paid position. In other words, you're putting somebody else out of work by volunteering for their position they would normally have. So I would say that to pay a person who comes back at the lowest entrance salary for that position is not, even though they're doing the work of somebody who is in their position and had more experience, that sort of gives the situation a black eye. That's about all I have to say. If you have any
questions for Ernie?
I have some questions.
Oh, Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Ernie, what percentage of your income did you retire at when you retired?
It was about 40%.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2421? Nope. Oh, yes. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, and this is my first time I have ever been in a legislative meeting. Obviously, I didn't come dressed for this. My daughter is Caitlin. My name is George Stillingworth. My daughter, Caitlin, is in Mr. Giles' second grade class. I have a great deal of respect for the gentleman and in what he's doing. Sitting here and listening, I've heard a few numbers tossed about, and I've had a few things that kind of strike me as being interesting. The 10%, which I hear being tossed out, you know, that is, as I understand it, that is a maximum. You know, I see very few things in life that ever attain their true maximum, you know, when you actually go out there and do things. Another thing I've heard is that people who are searching for work, who've been trained as teachers and are probably very skilled, and I would like to ask you gentlemen a question. How many of you have a political science degree? You know, most people, you know, when you get a degree, it is a nice piece of paper, something you fall back on to use, to utilize in your future career. However, the actual utilization of that degree does not necessarily become the field you choose. So, those are just some thoughts I wanted to throw out as a nobody in a meeting where decisions are made that will influence me in a minor way. So.
Thank you, George. Well, we can assure you you're not a nobody, and we appreciate your testimony, and you don't have to dress up for us. It's not necessary. Any questions? Thanks for coming. Appreciate it. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2421? Seeing no one else, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2421. And I think that completes our agenda for today, and we'll look forward to hearing from the employees and employers on Thursday with their final resolution on what they can come to an agreement on. Committee adjourned.
Thank you, Deborah.